our position has been to take a step back and to say if it's going to happen, it should happen on our terms to the greatest degree possible.
Interior Secretary Salazar hears from both sides of the offshore development debate. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 14th of April. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, opponents of the Pebble Mine plan take their protests to London.
I think I know as a board member when I'm being pacified, and that's kind of what I felt.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Association of Alaska School Boards. Parents that read to their children foster early learning and educational development for children and youth. Information at aasb.org.
Interior Secretary Ken Salazar visited Anchorage today to collect Alaskans' views on offshore oil and gas development. It's part of a series of meetings he is holding around the country to gather more public input on a 5-year draft lease sale plan the Bush administration implemented days before leaving office. It includes sales in Bristol Bay and the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas. Salazar heard a range of views on the issue from Alaskans and says he will have a tough decision to make. APRN's Annie Fight reports.
Outside the Denaina Convention Center before the hearing, a huge crowd rallied with signs reading, "America needs Alaskan oil, and it's about jobs." The rally leaders marched around a one-block area carrying a coffin that they said represented the victims of Outer Continental Shelf drilling delays. The chanting was led by members of the local Labor's International Union. Pat Phelan says he wasn't organizing the rally, but someone handed him a bullhorn and he took over.
It's about the Alaskan worker, for the economy, for jobs, and to put oil back in the pipeline.
Hey, ho, ho, foreign oil's got you go!
Outside, the crowd was decidedly pro-development, but inside, the views were very mixed. Secretary Salazar began the hearing by saying he wanted an open and honest conversation. He said he felt the lease sale plan had been rushed through by the Bush administration.
Given the importance of the Outer Continental Shelf, it requires that we take our time to make sure that the next steps we take are the correct steps.
Salazar first heard from Governor Palin and Alaska's congressional delegation, all who support offshore oil development if it's done responsibly. About 500 others signed up to testify. They represented local governments, native groups, environmental organizations, the oil industry, and fishermen. Alan Parks drove up from Homer to say Bristol Bay is not an appropriate place for oil and gas development. He described the morning 20 years ago after the Exxon Valdez ran aground in Prince William Sound when he was preparing his boat to fish for herring.
A fellow came by the boat and said, you might as well stop working on that because you're not going herring fishing. And I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, there's a tanker up on the rocks. And I go, well, they'll take care of it. They'll clean it up. They'll get that off the rocks. They'll get that oil out of Prince William Sound. I have not been herring fishing in Prince William Sound since then.
But other fishermen thought the development would be okay if it was done right. One fishing group asked that the Interior Department develop an oil spill plan and an adequate fisheries disaster fund. Native leaders also testified on both sides of the issue. Richard Glenn is a whaler in Barrow and a vice president at Arctic Slope Regional Corporation. He said weighing the potential risks and benefits of offshore development in the Chukchi and Beaufort Seas has been tricky for local villages.
And this is an issue that's testing the fiber of each of our communities. And so if our position appears conflicted, we're appropriately conflicted because we value the environment and we depend on the resources.
But he said opposing the development outright was counterproductive.
For me, arguing whether you're for or against OCS development is like whether you're arguing for or against gravity. Our position has been to take a step back and to say if it's going to happen, it should happen on our terms to the greatest degree possible.
Other Barrow residents who testified saw it very differently. Doreen Lampe supports a moratorium on drilling in the Arctic Ocean. As she spoke during her allotted time, Secretary Salazar jumped in to ask a question.
Do you...
This cannot affect my 3 minutes, then.
No. Is there a different point of view with respect to the Chukchi and the Beaufort proposed lease sales?
There is a big difference. You can clearly see the Beaufort Sea practices and exercises is to connect to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which currently they're doing. But in the Chukchi Sea, we have no idea. There have been no comprehensive oil and gas plan by industry to show us how they safely plan to market that oil and gas resource to the rest of the world.
Salazar listened attentively to each comment and said the final decision will factor in three essential elements: global warming, national security, and job creation. He said the Obama administration could decide to go ahead with some of the lease sales and abandon others.
I think everything is on the table. You know, we are not prejudging the outcome of this process.
Before leaving, Salazar promised to visit Alaska again this summer to see more of the state. During the hearing, he also reaffirmed the Obama administration's commitment to look at developing more renewable energy resources at the same time it considers developing oil and gas offshore. The public comment period is open until September. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The Palin administration today presented changes it wants in the way the legislature spends the federal economic stimulus money that the state can claim. The bill passed the House on Friday. Director of Management and Budget Karen Rehfeld told the Senate Finance Committee that the state can use the federal money to extend the state's money.
One of the ideas that we have been discussing in relationship to the federal dollars coming to the state through the Economic Stimulus Act would be to the extent that we can replace general funds and not supplant general funds, but replace general funds that we had intended to incorporate into our budget and utilize instead some of the Reinvestment Act funds for those purposes.
At the top of the changes Rehfeld mentioned was a proposal to eliminate an extra municipal revenue sharing payment to every community in the state. Instead, the $21 million would go to repairs of five schools in St. Mary's, Craig, Kodiak, Diomede, and Kel-Tag. That idea did not receive a good reception. Bethel's Lyman Hoffman supports forwarding money to the municipalities.
This is going to give the local communities some flexibility to decide what they want to do in their small part in helping stimulate the economies in the communities throughout the state of Alaska. So I'm very supportive of that portion of the funding.
And Steve Cunningham, the city clerk from Houston, asked that the revenue sharing option be protected.
We live in an economically depressed area, not much infrastructure at this time, and there are hopes and dreams, but at this time, we do need that extra assistance that the revenue sharing does provide to us.
The bill remains in the Finance Committee. The Ketchikan Bay Research Reserve is seeking federal economic stimulus package money to clean up derelict fishing gear and crab pots from the bay. Research Reserve Manager Terry Thompson says the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration put out a call for proposals recently asking for habitat restoration projects that are ready to go. KBRR is seeking $1.74 million for a two-year project, including a survey to get some idea of how many derelict crab pots there are in Ketchikan Bay.
That's one of the things that will be determined by this survey that we'll be doing. Anecdotal information says that there are thousands.
Thompson says if they get the grant, they'll use sophisticated equipment to locate the pots. Once that's done, they'll make a decision about whether or not to remove them or let them stay at the bottom of the ocean. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a bizarre patrol story, vessel story that ends well.
We've been out clear up into the Yakutat area offshore, out on the outer coast in bad weather, and she handles fine.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Former Alaska Senator Ted Stevens can practice law again in the nation's capital. The District of Columbia Court of Appeals has reinstated his license a week after his felony conviction was dismissed. APRN's Libby Casey reports.
Ted Stevens lost his law license in Washington and California soon after his October conviction for lying on financial forms about gifts. But last week, a federal judge vacated the guilty verdict and threw out the charges against him because of prosecutorial misconduct. District of Columbia Court of Appeals Clerk Garland Pinkston Jr. says the D.C. Bar Council filed paperwork on Friday to have Stevens' law license reinstated.
Suspended on an interim basis based on the conviction. The conviction no longer exists, therefore his interim suspension should no longer exist.
The California Bar Association has not yet acted on reinstating Stevens' license. However, the Alaska Bar Association dropped its call last week to have Stevens' license suspended in his home state. The former senator is 85 years old and was voted out of office last fall soon after his conviction. Before his four decades in the Senate, he practiced law and worked as a federal prosecutor. It's not yet known if he'll choose to resume practicing law. Stevens faces paying off what are likely millions of dollars in legal fees from his court battle. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The state of Alaska has won a lawsuit over the shoddy construction of a Southeast Patrol vessel, winning an award that's double the original construction cost. But it's unclear whether the state will ever get the money. From KTOO in Juneau, Matt Miller has the story.
The shipyard and their insurance company didn't even bother to show up and defend themselves in court. So the state of Alaska won by default.
Yeah, it was very strange. I mean, incredibly strange.
Richard Welsh is a state attorney who specialized in claims and admiralty law. He was put on the case of the bungled construction of the Enforcer. That's a 69-foot patrol vessel used by the Department of Public Safety in Southeast Waters. It was built by Kennedy Ship and Repair of Galveston, Texas.
The principal of that outfit was a fellow by the name of Chris Kennedy, and ultimately just basically abandoned the case. We continued to serve him with all court documents. The court served him as well. And, I'm guessing perhaps a year, he just totally ignored us.
It all started when the state solicited bids for a new patrol boat for Southeast Fisheries, something that could launch skiffs and pull up pots and other fishing gear. Back in January of 2005, the state handed over the final payment to Kennedy Shipyard for the $1.4 million vessel. But just a week later, as it was being loaded onto a carrier vessel, one of the slings broke and the Enforcer was partially dropped on its bow. It was then, during an inspection in a Vancouver shipyard, that the state realized they had been sold a lemon.
There were internal deficiencies that weren't discovered until folks had an opportunity to crawl inside the vessel. Once they got inside compartments and so forth, they discovered shoddy workmanship, deficient components and so forth. As I said, we brought that to the attention of Kennedy and demanded that they honor their warranty. They quite simply refused to do so.
Everything from peeling paint to poor welds, a missing structural rib frame, no watertight bulkheads, garden hoses instead of marine-grade fuel lines. Even worse, the vessel was dangerous, even with the builder adding 7 tons of pig iron for ballast.
Their stability test that they conducted was, inaccurate or false.
Donald Starbird, vessel supervisor for the Department of Public Safety, says they had to keep the vessel tied up during icing conditions or winds over 30 knots.
If, for instance, I took the boat out down near Ketchikan on my own observation and went out and made a just slow ahead 4 knots, made a hard turn to port, and the boat heeled over drastically to starboard. The cabin heeled way over, and most boats would come back, they'd rock back and forth. Well, in this case, the Enforcer just stayed heeled over during the whole turn, and if there were wind or waves involved, that would have been a dangerous situation, and that was in good conditions at slow speed.
Starbird says another vessel built by Kennedy was also unusable. The 45-foot Churchill is still out of the water in Cordova, waiting for a potential buyer to take on repairs. And the company that provided the surety bond for Kennedy, well, that may have been a complete scam.
We did look into the matter extensively. We just simply were unable to get the surety to respond to our repeated requests. We also did some research and discovered that the states of Florida and Texas, I believe, have brought actions against the surety and basically have enjoined them from conducting business in those states.
International Fidelity and Surety Limited listed its corporate headquarters in the Republic of Vanuatu, a South Pacific island nation with a notorious reputation as a tax haven. Federal regulators shut them down in this country in late 2007 for being an unlicensed insurance company and charged 8 people with fraud. So what's all this mean for Alaska? In Juneau Superior Court recently, Welsh was able to win over a $1.6 million judgment against Kennedy Shipyard for the extra work and almost $1.4 million from IFS to cover the deficiency repairs. But actually collecting all that money, well, that's another thing.
Ultimately, whether we will or not, I'm not sure, but we certainly intend to pursue that to its end, and if there's money there, we'll collect on it.
Now the state has a marine engineering firm on contract to prevent such disasters from happening again. And as for the Enforcer itself, it's a completely different boat.
It is an outstanding vessel now.
It just took another 2 years and nearly 3 times the original cost for the state to get the boat it wanted. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
A group of Bristol Bay commercial fishermen and Alaska natives are in London to let Anglo-American corporate leaders know about their concerns over the Pebble Mine proposal near Iliamna. Today, the delegation met with Anglo-American CEO Cynthia Carroll. Bobby Andrews is a board member of Nunumta Aluxtai, an Alaska Native conservation organization comprised of 8 village corporations. Andrews says he felt that Carroll and other Anglo-American corporate leaders listened closely to his comments, but he says he still feels they will push ahead with their plans. He said he was most encouraged after the group showed the film Red Gold to London citizens. The documentary highlights the salmon resource in Bristol Bay. Andrews says people wanted to know how to get involved.
I'm confident they're going to be looking at AK2UK to get more information as well as getting in contact with their conservation groups in London in order to figure out what they can do to help.
Tom Tilden is the chief of the Churyung Tribal Council. He says he is totally against the mine because of the location and hydrology of the area. He believes there is no safe way to develop the mine and protect the waters that flow into Bristol Bay. Tilden says Anglo-American executives said once they have a firm set of plans, they would take 6 months to bring it to the residents of the Bristol Bay region.
And come and meet with all the villages and I'd say, okay, this is our plan. Go ahead and give us your comments on this first.
But Tilden says their words were not comforting to him.
I think I know as a board member when I'm being pacified, and that's kind of what I felt.
Tilden says he was most impressed after a tour of Tiffany's Jewelers and the commitment of Tiffany's president that they would not buy gold from the Pebble Mine if it's developed.
Yeah. This can cost you millions, or it can benefit you, but there's that risk there. But they were willing and they were happy to do it. I was very, very impressed by that, by Tiffany's move.
Tomorrow, the group will bring their opposition message to Anglo-American shareholders during their annual meeting in London.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
Deeper snow, thicker ice, and cooler than normal temperatures indicate high flood potential in several areas of the state. That's according to the National Weather Service, which has issued its annual spring breakup outlook for Alaska. The agency's River Forecast Center tracks ice thickness on the state's major rivers, and center hydrologist Larry Runquist says a few locations are showing substantial ice buildup.
The Kuskokwim River is running a little above average, about 120% of average ice thickness. The Yukon River up at Eagle is up at close to 140% of normal, so it's pretty thick up there. So we definitely have sufficient ice out there, you know, at or above normal on the Yukon and Kuskokwim, which are two of the rivers that have the greatest flood threats.
Rehnquist says measurements at other locations in the interior, including Fairbanks, show more normal ice, while ice cover on south-central Alaska rivers is slightly thinner than normal. Meanwhile, much of the state has normal to well above normal snowpack. That's a concern if a sudden warm-up causes heavy runoff into ice-choked rivers, a recipe for ice jam flooding. Junior and senior marine biology students at Mount Edgecombe had the opportunity last week to perform a necropsy on a sea lion that was found floating near Thompson Harbor. The National Marine Fisheries Services allowed the students to take samples from the animal for both education and possibly to discover the cause of death. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
Sitkin Ray Nielsen says initially when he saw the sea lion drifting near the airplane float, he thought it was a log.
I waited for a fishing game. They said sea lion, so I went and got a skiff. It was already at Thompson. I towed it over here, signaling the kids. This is my intent. I'm real happy to see this happen.
Nielsen's referring to the opportunity the students have to learn from the necropsy. And he was happy to help out with the effort. Standing by with a grin on his face, I asked him to describe the sea lion.
Very dead, very deteriorated. I don't know if male or female, but probably a big male. Got a hole in the side. They've been dead for a while, bloated.
As a veterinarian, I do a lot of necropsies, especially through the Raptor Center, because we're often curious to know how the bald eagles died.
Veterinarian Victoria Vosberg says this particular necropsy is an opportunity for her as well.
I don't do a lot of mammal necropsies, so I was really interested to see this.
We've got the head here. There are a few students. Yesterday, they were like, which end is which? So just to kind of do a little bit of orientation, one thing that we noticed when we were first out here is that he's got some red marks on the flipper and then right here on the side.
Chola Mole teaches this marine biology class. The students have clipboards with a list of the samples they'll need to send off to a lab for the National Marine Fisheries Service. Sonny Vincent is also on hand from NIMFS.
In this case, since the animal was a little farther along in decomp and the class was here and could get some benefit out of it, we decided, or it was decided through our Protected Resources Division, to allow the class to conduct the necropsy as long as they took the samples that were requested and filled out our what's called a Level A marine stranding report.
One thing that's interesting is looking at this blood supply. Those are huge blood vessels, but this is terribly bruised. This is just not normal coloring. That indicates some sort of trauma.
Mole is definitely a hands-on biology teacher. Decked out in orange rain gear, she's using an axe to separate the sternum so they can get a look at the heart.
Like look at that. Lots of really dark, blood. Dark black blood in the esophagus. Write that down.
Doesn't have to be
Wow, look at that. Wow.
Yep, I was just going to ask, how many chambers? Does anyone remember the names of the chambers?
Most of the students are also wearing surgical masks to help deal with the smell.
It's pretty gross.
But for some, it's not that different than subsistence activities they were raised with. Sharon Horner is from Kobuk.
I think it's very interesting because my first time seeing a sea lion cut open, but I have cut a moose and stuff, so I'm... This is awesome.
Vosberg says they don't know the cause of death, but there are several possibilities that need to be ruled out.
At this point, we do not know. Chola mentioned the red on there, so could be bottom paint. That's a possibility. I also noticed there's a hole. So, unfortunately, I think we should consider gunshot as well.
But retired teacher Marty Johnson, who continues to volunteer for classes at Mount Edgecombe, says they may never really know how this sea lion died.
It has to be pretty obvious for us. You know, there was quite a bit of blood in the abdominal cavity, which normally you don't find that, which could have meant, a ruptured spleen from an impact. Since there was bottom paint on it, but that's all just speculation. It was so bloated and floating, it could have just floated up against the boat and the waves rubbed the bottom paint onto it.
Mole says she's thrilled that the students had the opportunity to be able to dissect something this large. They've done rats and frogs, and in the fall they've done porpoises and other mammals through the Whale Fest Science in the Schools program. But to have something in the spring is a rare treat, although Moll was also really clear that there is protocol the kids need to observe.
This is an animal that was living, and we want to be respectful of it. We're learning from it right now. So I really want you guys to think about the comments that you're making while we're doing this dissection. Okay?
In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
This is pancreas.
Oh, that's a big pancreas.
Three comic actors from New York performed on the Kenai Peninsula over the last few weeks. The improv group Sidecar spent time at area schools using humor to teach about the history of Alaska. KDLL's Ben Stanton has more.
Students filed into Mr. Harbison's history class and later were joined by another class for an unusual lesson. Sidecar members Justin Tyler and Matt Fisher start the performance seeming to struggle coming up with actual facts about Alaska.
Alaska, founded in...
Founded in olden times.
Yes.
That's until the third member and Alaska native, Alden Ford, shows up and sets them straight on a few things.
I mean, we all know that Superman lives in Antarctica.
I tried to anchor it on Superman and bring it back down to reality a little bit.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. That's what this show is about, to learn about Alaska. For instance, did you know that the word Alaska comes from the native word Alaksksay, which literally means the object towards which the action of the sea is directed?
Oh, that's a little bit.
Before the performance, the three actors took time to explain some of their background. Ford says he started working with Tyler about 3 years ago.
We were both students, or he was a performer. I was a student at the time at Upright Citizens Brigade in New York, which is an improv comedy theater. And we started talking improv, and he was looking to start a group, and I was looking to join one. And so we started working together a little bit, and a few months later, Matt moved to the city. And he moved there from Boston to continue his comedy career, and we started working together.
Now, in Alaska, the group has already been to Seward, Homer, Anchorage, and Kiski, and given several performances at the Triumvirate Theater in Soldotna. Their performance at Sohaya this week included short sketches blending local history and improvised comedy. Here, they are three generals talking about the importance of Alaska during World War II.
I am a general. It should come from a place of respect.
You keep saying that, but it sounds fake.
I know. Generals don't say that so much. They don't constantly shout, I'm a general.
Field generals are being in danger of being slapped by other generals.
Fisher says that the show takes on a different feel in the classroom compared to the stage.
Yeah, it's fun to perform the set at schools because our show is educational in some respects, but doing it in a theater, it contains a lot more history than your average sketch comedy show at a theater. But to come and do it at a school, especially for high school kids or history students, you realize just how much comedy frosting has been put on the information cake.
In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Kelly in Homer, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka, Matt Miller in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ben Stanton in Kenai. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future. First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by Comfort Suites Anchorage International Airport. Comfort Suites, an all-suites hotel, is now open with a 24-hour shuttle service, indoor pool, and high-speed internet access. Reservations at 243-8080.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.